Many recreational hikers have stopped along the trail to admire a wildflower, only to wonder what exactly they are seeing. Wildflowers of the Mountain West from Utah State University Press is a new field guide to help make flower confirmation easy. It's organized by color along with descriptions and full color photos to aid in identification. We'll talk with the authors in the first half of the program. For Petals and Prose, Helen Cannon joins us once again to bring us the prose of E.B. White and his insights into the garden essays of his wife, New Yorker editor Catherine White. Then we'll talk with iris hybridizer Brad Kasparek of Zebra Gardens near Tremonton. While tall bearded iris usually steal the show in most gardens, there are other types of iris that do well in our intermountain soils. What you might think are Japanese or Siberian iris are usually Spurria iris. They bloom 2 to 3 weeks after tall bearded, and Brad is one of the few Spurria hybridizers actively working to expand the selection. You'll find all of this today on The Zesty Garden. But first, the news. Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden this Thursday. I'm your host, Brian Earle. Today on the program, we have a variety of guests. We have everything from wildflowers of the Mountain West to the Spurria iris of Zebra Gardens, and then also our Petals and Prose segment. So I hope you'll stay with us throughout the program. But to begin the program, we're going to talk about the book, The Wildflowers of the Mountain West. And this is a fairly recent introduction from Utah State University Press. And the authors of the book, at least two of them will be joining me on the phone, J.D. Gunnell and Jerry L. Goodspeed. The other author is Richard M. Anderson. And this is a great book if you're looking for something to take with you on your hike. So, and to help you identify plants, this might be the book for you. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, Jerry, you are in Ogden. Are you at the Botanical Center?
I am.
Okay.
At both Ogden and Caseville, yep.
Okay. So, but you're calling us from there?
I'm calling you actually from Salt Lake.
Okay. And JD, where are you located right now?
I'm in the Salt Lake office. I dragged Jerry down here today.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you joining me on the program. And when I got the book in the mail, the first thing that I noticed was that it's spiral bound. And it has kind of a glossy cover, and actually the insides are ones that if you spill something on it, it's not going to likely stain the pages too bad. You can brush it off. So this has been made so that you can carry it in a backpack and easily pull it out because it's not too large, but it's larger than a pocketbook. Tell me about the evolution of the book. How did this come about? Why did you decide to put it together?
Well, we were actually up in the Albion Basin area, just east of Salt Lake, and we were taking...
This is about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, and we had a group of friends that we were walking around and trying to help them identify some of the flowers that they were seeing, and a lot of the books we had with us were huge, very technical. They're some of our personal books that we've acquired, and it was difficult to show the people how to use those technical books. And it led actually to quite some frustration. And so after the event, we sat down and with...
Right there in the field we did.
Yeah, and we thought, you know, how can we do this better? We both are extension agents with the university, and part of our job is to bring research-based information and knowledge at a grassroots level. And so... You know, we thought this is perfect. This is a case study where we can influence for the good.
So you actually sat down in the field and started to sketch out what you would want to see in a book?
Yeah, and actually it's interesting you picked up on the spiral binding first. That was the very first thing that we mentioned, that in the mountain areas there's a lot of wind oftentimes, and we thought, you know, we need a book that will stay open. And the hard binding wasn't cutting it.
Well, and like I said, the size of the book makes it easy to put in a backpack and pull out. The other thing that I have noticed with the book is that it's organized by color instead of the more traditional by genus. Why go that direction?
Well, actually, it is both. The color, you know, what J.D. said was so true. There are some books out there that identify flowers, and there's no color to them. There's some that do it by family, and they're all. It's really hard if you're just a layman just to pick up a book and say, you know, the bottom line is, how do I identify this flower? And we wanted to figure out a way to make that just as easy as possible. And you'll notice even in the back, there's a little quick key that we call it that shows you some distinguishing features. Once you have the color and the flower type, then you can kind of look at a distinguishing feature. So that was our thinking, is what's the easiest way to identify a flower for somebody? And the color is also confusing at times.
Well, and you can look at a flower and you think it's one thing, but it's probably not. It could be something else. And I do like how you put in here all of the basic information, plant size, color. You've got it arranged by color. And then at the very front of the book, you can actually take it and look. There you've got some sketchings of flower arrangements, basic flower shapes, the flower parts, different things to help you identify the plant.
Yeah, and one thing that made it really nice to have three of us writing the book is each of us tackled an issue differently, and we viewed it differently. And so the book has each of our input.
So why don't you talk about that? Who had what? And how did you decide? Who decided what to do?
Well, we call J.D. Trapper. Or he can spot. Okay, so one of the tricks is to be able to do horticulture at about 45 miles an hour as you're driving down the road. And I cannot do this, but watching J.D., I mean, he can spot our tracker. I said trapper, but tracker is what we call him. But he can spot a wildflower from, you know, 100 yards away doing 45 miles an hour. And that's pretty incredible. Very good at being able to identify. Maybe it's just my old eyes, but J.D. was very good at finding the flowers, tracking them down. And Richard is more of the botanist, phenologist, taxonomist. He's the specialty, knows the plants, and he would just amaze JD and I as we would walk out in the field. He'd look down and we'd look down and we'd say, "Well, what's that?" And he'd rattle off this name. And I think the first year or two, we would kind of question him, because then he'd start talking about history. He'd say, "Well, Lewis and Clark found this on October 7th. And, you know, we'd kind of smile and say, "Yeah, whatever." But he's right. So he's very good at that technical stuff.
And then Jerry was the bring it down to earth level, where we would take the pictures. We'd go to the herbaria on campus and actually in Idaho and Wyoming and the other surrounding states to find the specimens. And we'd read the literature. We wanted to make sure that it was taxonomically correct so that all levels of people could enjoy it. But then after we would read the taxonomic information, then Jerry was very good at bringing it down to a common level that people would be able to understand. So when we're describing the ray and disc flowers of the aster family, then we would call them petals, but then in parentheses put the correct taxonomic verbiage. So it was really interesting. I think with all three of us having our specialty niches, it became a really great book.
So how did you decide what to throw out? Because I can imagine with the three of you, you have a ton of information. It could have been five times this size. So how did you get through that winnowing process?
There was a few heated discussions. We each have our favorite plants, and we didn't want to see any of them go. But when it came to publishing, the publisher gave us a very distinct, this is how many pages it needs to stay to keep it within reason. And to be honest, a lot of these plants that are in the book are the most common. They're the ones that reoccurred as we went through all the different states. And so we wanted to have a broad range. So that's kind of the glasses that we looked through is, would this be picked up in Reno and Salt Lake and still have validity?
Well, and even though it's limited to the Mountain West region, I mean, that's, looking at the map that you have on here, that's still a very large and varied area. It's going from, it doesn't include Denver and Colorado Springs, but basically from the Front Range of Colorado all the way over to the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. So how do you decide what's going to go in the book when you've got such a large area?
Yeah, that's a really good, kind of like what JD said, we tried to find what was most common, and when we would travel to different places, it would change a little bit because we would, you know, you would think, well, we're going to find this and this, but we'd find something else more common, and then we would have to look at it and say, okay, if you're in Rocky Mountain National Park, what are you going to want to identify first? Are you going to say something, JD?
No, sorry, I was just clearing my throat.
Oh, and that's, you know, as we went to it, that's more or less what we did, Brian. Then we sat down, like JD said, we sat down, and the other talent that JD has is a photographer. He's very good. Most of those pictures you see are JD's. And so then we would sit down at the end of, you know, a month or two, and then we'd sit down and go through, and I'm not kidding you, literally thousands of pictures and looking at them and deciding, okay, this one, you know, represents really good what it is, and this one, and to be honest with you, a couple of the plants we liked, but we had to throw out because it was really hard to photograph them, and they weren't really spectacular plants, but
or they weren't very commonly found.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and if this book is meant for a layperson to be able to identify a plant, if there's not a flower on it, I mean, it's bad to say, but they're probably not going to be looking at it either.
That's exactly right, and that was part of the determining factor. Is if, and a couple of plants we threw out because they're pretty abundant, but the flower isn't very spectacular. And even though it is in flower, it's just really not noticeable. Even though they may be very abundant, if nobody notices them, then it's not really going to help anybody because nobody's looking at them.
You mentioned photography. What about the timing? These all don't blossom at the same time. So, how much hiking was being done to get these all photographed?
We were in really good shape.
You can't tell that now. But
no, I. What is it? Over 16,000 miles that we logged.
Something like that. Yeah, it's a lot.
We went to all the different, you know, and that's the great thing with working with the university is when we told our supervisors our vision of what we wanted to do, they were very supportive and allowed us to the freedom to go and do this.
So,
but we
as long as we maintained our other jobs. So, yeah, they were very supportive.
So then did you first determine what flowers to go in the book and then look at the time of year it's in blossom and then go out and look for it so you can take a photo of it?
Sometimes. That's how it started, is we thought, you know, as JD said, we would go and look in the herbariums for the vouchers, and on the voucher it'll tell you where it is and when it's in bloom. But what we found happens is as soon as we go there, we're not guaranteed to find that flower, but we will find other flowers. And yeah, we did have a list to begin with. And JD, was it about 300 flowers?
Yeah. Then over 3 years, we would go out each season and find different things and different timing. I mean, these flowers were hugely dependent on the moisture and the weather. So luckily, we had some really great springs. The spring after we finished writing the book, I couldn't find a wildflower to save my life. And so
last year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was just a lot of drought and a lot of problems.
So that must have worked pretty well because you had 2 years of somewhat wet springs, so that must have made for a profusion of blooming.
It really helped, yeah.
So I'm looking at some of the various flowers, and it's kind of amazing at the geographic distribution of these. If you've got arrowleaf groundsel going from southwestern and southern Colorado all the way up to Burns, Oregon, sticky geranium, it's pretty much found all throughout the area.
They are, and you know, a lot of times these wildflowers, the early plant explorers would come and find them, and they would collect them and take them back, and some of these can even be found in the nursery industry. Jerry and I are doing a talk at Cactus and Tropicals, not this Saturday, but next, on how these plants get introduced into the nurseries. And so, yeah, you're right. The huge distribution shows us that, horticulturally speaking, that we could probably utilize those in our landscapes relatively easily.
What percentage of these do you think are available to the average homeowner?
I would say not enough.
Yeah, I don't think it's a really large. And we're working at the university. That was the other part of this project that came out of it. It was the book came out, but at the same time, we realized that there's a lot of plants out there that especially for Utah or the Intermountain area that's very dry, there are a lot of plants out there that we can work with and introduce into the nursery industry, which will conserve moisture in the gardens, but will also are just beautiful. I mean, there are some beautiful plants that we found. And so the other part of the project is, since then, we have also begun a plant introduction program at Utah State University called Sago Supreme. And we will start introducing more and more of these natives as Richard does the majority of the work on them, but as he works with them and as we breed them and as we develop them so that they'll bloom longer, have more colorful blooms, and then we'll start introducing them more and more into the nursery industry.
So would you suggest, as you see these coming into the nurseries, just to make sure you can, like I'm looking at the heartleaf arnica. I'm guessing it's probably, I haven't actually read all the way through. Oh, there it is. Open woodlands, stream banks, aspen, and spruce groves. So it's not going to want to have a really dry climate. And if I'm living at, say, in St. George, I'm probably not going to want to grow it either. So there are different things that you'll need to know about each of these flowers if you see them in the stores.
That's correct. That arnica is more of a shade-loving plant, and it is one that we're looking at for shade areas, because a lot of times most of the plants that we're selling right now are sun-loving, and a lot of people say, yeah, but I'm growing trees and I have shady areas, so that would be one in the future that we can look at for shady locations.
And that would bring some bright color to a shady location as well. It's not the usual cool colors in the shade.
That's correct.
So, okay, this side note here, why is Wasatch County the only one in the state of Utah that doesn't have heartleaf arnica?
Okay, so these distribution maps are based on herbaria records.
Okay.
But also, through our personal observation and going these 16,000 miles around the western United States, we noticed that we saw things in counties that weren't marked. And so I believe that there's just not enough flower people in Wasatch County.
So it's likely this is growing in Wasatch County. It's just like you said, it hasn't been marked.
It's very likely.
It is. We just tried to keep it research-based so that it is what has been documented, and like JD said, either documented through a voucher or we found it.
If someone who lives in that county is able to identify a flower where it shows on these maps that it hasn't been identified, who can they call to say, you know, we've identified this flower, or to send in a sample? I guess you don't want a sample sent in. How do they get that then identified?
Well, that's what the herbarium is for, is to accept those vouchers. And then, you know, I think that's part of the fun of having a wildflower book is making your own discoveries. And this last 3 years, I think I've learned more about horticulture than I did throughout my whole career as a student.
Amen. Yeah.
And so I think I'm not unique in that, and that people enjoy learning. And I would tell them to mark it in their book and then make a note and let us know. We can make the changes in our second edition, because we already have a whole list of plants we want to add.
Well, I could see someone taking this book and using it like a bird guide. I know in my own Sibley guide, I write down the date, the time, the location, the area where I saw it, the different conditions that I saw that bird. I could be doing that with this book.
Oh, definitely.
You know, we thought about that. We thought about, do we add something in the back? Because I've got a bird book, too, where you kind of, it lists all the birds, and then you can mark it when you've seen them and stuff. And we did talk about doing that, but page-wise, we thought, you know, you can just mark them in the book itself. But that is what's kind of fun to me. I agree.
Well, this is a live program. I keep forgetting to tell people. You can call in with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. We're talking with J.D. Gunnell and Jerry Goodspeed, two of the three authors of the new published book from Utah State University Press, Wildflowers of the Mountain West. J.D. Gunnell is a horticulture associate professor for Utah State University in Salt Lake County and also oversees the arboretum development at the USU Botanical Center. Jerry is a horticulture associate professor for USU Extension in Weber County and co-directs two of USU-funded botanical gardens. Now,
That's a whole mouthful, Brian.
Yeah, I'm reading that. It's all hair in the back if anybody wants to read it.
I was going to say, just say they're plant nerds and we're good.
Okay, so I'm looking at your map of the Mountain West region. One of the things that comes to mind is how do all of these plants develop in such a varied region? I mean, this isn't something that's happened in the last couple thousand years. This has been going over a long period of time. So how do you find the same flower in Colorado that's also growing in Oregon, yet have the diversity that's going on? Because you've got climate changes that have happened. You've got, you call it, this is a new word for me, it makes sense, orogeny from orographic lifting, I'm assuming.
Yep.
So
yep.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
We need Richard. Help! Go ahead, JD.
Well, the skinny of it is just like you mentioned, it's hundreds and hundreds of years of lifting and mountains being formed and these islands being created at the
lakes,
tops of the mountains,
yeah,
where these different ecosystems have formed in time and the strong have survived. And a lot of the more drought tolerant and sun loving species have ended up doing well in southern aspects, where the more alpine wildflowers have developed, you know, resistance to the cold, and it's amazing to watch nature and how these things have evolved. But it's been hundreds and hundreds of years, and we get to just take a
millions.
Snapshot of where things are now.
Yeah, and they're continually changing, and that's the other fun thing is, I mean, plants adapt as the climate changes, as man changes things. The cool thing is that I find really cool is plants adapt, and they do change. And, at one time, it may have been all one, that like the groundsel you talked about. And, J.D., correct me, there's about 50 groundsels or not quite that many?
There's a lot.
And our guess is, the guess is they all started from one, but as they have – as the ground has changed, as the climates have changed, as things have changed, each of the different pockets of it have adapted, either grow bigger leaves, smaller leaves, taller, shorter, different color flowers, whatever it be, to where they're located at, and thus we have the wide variety of them.
Well, and you probably also have something like, when you're looking at Utah being having the largest number of penstemons, kind of the same thing, maybe as the climate developed and went on, they just kind of all started to separate.
Yes, that's exactly right. They had to. I mean, and to me, I mean, you know me a little bit, Brian. You know that I get excited about nature and I get excited about horticulture. And this is one of the things that really does excite me is the diversity and the when you look on a small scale, and that's what I liked about the book too, is we show different pictures of the plants so that you can see the different uniqueness of each of the plants and how cool it is and what separates it from some of the others.
And the environment that they are naturally found. So you can take cues from nature, like coral bells, the heuchera. They are all over the nursery industry, a lot of different colors, and they've done a lot of breeding programs with heuchera, but it's one of our natives, and one of the first ones were found Stansberry Islands in the 1800s, and, it's amazing. You take a cue from nature where things are naturally thriving, and then you try to replicate that.
Well, if you'd like to call into our program, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. You know, I was looking in here, and I have no idea if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Frossera speciosa. I got all excited about it, and then I read, this plant can live multiple years but dies once it blooms. Well, that kind of defeats the purpose of having it in your own yard, but does it stay spiky like that all the time, or is it like a rosette before it flowers?
Are you talking about the elkweed?
Sorry, green gentian?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that one,
to answer your question, yeah, it is a rosette, and then it does bloom up.
And what did you call it, elk?
Green gentian's the proper name.
Elkweed, but the Fraser eye.
Yeah.
So why decide not to put in the common name?
Well, they're there as well. The problem with common names is there's a lot of them. If you go to Cache County, someone will call it by one name. Down here in Salt Lake, it's a totally different name. So we have to depend on the botanical.
We tried to add that, Brian. What we have also in there is, it's really weird because, I mean, even in scientific literature, you'll go and you'll find four or five different common names for one plant. So we tried to pick one common name that it could be known by, that most people know it by, plus a scientific name. And so when we say elkweed, that's what a lot of us in Utah call it, but they wouldn't call that in Colorado or
Well, that makes sense because it develops according to your experience. And so that does make sense. Well, we have our first caller. We have Sue in Logan. Hi, Sue. How can we help?
Well, actually, I just have a comment rather than
sure.
a question. I was driving to work this morning, and I was feeling really sad because I live in Logan, and I see all the trees being destroyed, cut down, butchered, the way they're hacked apart. And I just started just looking at the trees and realizing that for me, trees and shrubs and plants and they all have souls. These are living entities that we should be cherishing and respecting. And so my comment is just a great big thank you, a wonderful sense of gratitude towards your guests today, that they are people who appreciate the nature of our world and our plant world, and I
we
appreciate
love it.
That
yeah.
there are other people like that in the world.
Oh, there are, believe me, and we do.
Yeah.
We quite enjoy it.
Well, Sue, you sound like you're going to be someone that will appreciate having a book like this when you go hiking.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that we need to all have bumper stickers that say trees are the answer, or maybe plants are the answer, because I think we think we better take good care of them. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue.
Bye-bye.
We have
and to kind of go along with Sue's comments, plants are the answer, but in my world, they're also the question. The more I get to know about these things, the less I feel like I know.
Well, and that's, for me, it's all about the experience. I guess you know this more than I do. You just never get all those questions answered because you do keep having more of them. The more I'm in my garden, the more I try to put native perennials in and try to figure out, well, why is it working here but not over there? That's part of the fun, is the exploration.
It is. And as soon as you know... Yeah, as soon as you know one thing, then something else pops up, or 10 other things pop up that you don't know. It almost asks more questions than it answers.
Well, I wanted to make sure that I mention the name of the book again before we get done, Wildflowers of the Mountain West. It is a publication from Utah State University Press. And before we go, I wanted to ask you both, what surprised you most about doing this book? And J.D., why don't we start with you?
Okay. The thing when Jerry and I and Richard get together, we kind of dream.
Kind of.
And so this is just one of many projects that we've done or are in the process of doing, and we have this kind of we can do this attitude. But I think the thing that surprised me most is how much gratification I got and education. Got out of the process. I, like I said before, I think I've learned more in the past 3 years writing this book, just about nature and plants in general and how they've developed and how we can appreciate them. It's made me a better person and more grateful.
Great. And you, Jerry?
And I'd kind of echo those, but the other thing that I learned that's credible is the diversity that's out there. And I, to appreciate the little small parts of the flower. Sometimes we look at the big picture, and I'm amazed at how many people just fly by or hike by and never see the beauty, but the minute beauty that's out there.
When I first started hiking with my soon-to-be wife, at least that was 20 years ago, she's one of those that likes to keep hiking and doesn't like to stop. And I can be that way to a point, but if I see something, I'll stop. And so she's had to get used to stopping quite a bit. And one of the pictures that I'm looking in here that makes me stop and look is King's Crown. And, I mean, that's just an absolutely gorgeous red flower. I don't know if I've ever noticed it before, but I love the comment that you've got next to the picture that says, also called rose root because its thick roots supposedly smell like roses. Just trust the authors and put the spade down. Was that you, Jerry?
That was Jerry.
Yeah.
we wanted to insert ourselves into this book and make sure that we shone through. And Jerry has a great sense of humor, and a lot of these comments come. They just came out when we were in the field, and we thought, you know what, we're putting that in the book.
And just as another note, Brian, when that's the other thing, is when we do this, you know, some people say, well, I'd love to go hiking with you, and we don't hike. We walk a few feet, and we stop, and we look at flowers, and we walk a few more feet. And so when people come, and we've only had a couple that have joined us, it drives them nuts because we don't hike. We enjoy nature.
And especially with Richard, I'm going to tell on him, he will make it 5 feet in 2 hours. He makes it a religious experience and sits there and becomes one with the plant. And I love it about him until it's lunchtime.
And then we got to go.
Well, we've been talking with the authors of Wildflowers of the Mountain West, a Utah State University Press publication. Authors are Richard Anderson, J.D. Gunnell, and Jerry Goodspeed. And J.D. and Jerry have been on the phone with us from Salt Lake City. Thank you both for joining me on the program today. I look forward to using the book.
Well, thanks so much for having us, Brian. We appreciate
you.
You bet. Coming up next is our Petals and Prose segment after a short break, and then we'll talk with Brad Kasparek of Zebra Gardens.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost, with 7 other productions June through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
In our Petals and Prose segment, Helen Cannon is reading some of both E.B. White, his introduction to his wife's book, Upward and Onward into the Garden. And Helen is a former teacher of English at Utah State University, and is a lover of poems and all different types of literature, as well as a lover in the garden. And she presents our next Petals and Prose segment.
Once again, I will be reading today from Catherine S. White's Onward and Upward in the Garden. And once again, this is the introduction written by her husband, E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web. In this issue of the March 1st, 1958, under the heading Books, The New Yorker ran a critical article on garden catalogs. It was signed Catherine S. White, its subhead being Onward and Upward in the Garden, and it was the first of what was to become a series of 14 garden pieces extending over a period of 12 years. To readers of the magazine, the first piece came as a surprise, I think a pleasant one, innovative in that its author, without warning or apology, plunged boldly into reviewing books of the seedsman, the nurseryman, and as though she were reviewing the latest novel. To the best of my knowledge, nobody had ever done this before in a magazine of general circulation. If the New Yorker's readers were surprised, imagine the condition of the seedsmen and nurserymen themselves. It must have been a dream come true for them to wake up and discover their precious catalogs and their purple prose were being examined by a critical mind in the pages of a well-regarded publication. Once having taken off, Catherine White lost no time in slipping into a critical mode. Quote, say you have a flower like the zinnia, she wrote. Clean cut, of interesting, positive form, with formal petals that are so neatly and cunningly put together, and with colors so subtle yet clear that they have always been the delightful of the still life artist. Then look at the W. Attlee Burpee and Joseph Harris Company catalogs and see what the seedsmen are doing to zinnias. There followed a gentle rebuke directed at the trend toward making flowers bigger and fancier. From that moment, she was off and running. Seedsmen, hybridizers, nurserymen hung onto their hats and read about themselves, their triumphs, their failures, their conceits, their prose style, with a mixture of awe, thanksgiving, and skepticism. They were being scrutinized in public by a woman who, whatever else she was an opinionated gardener, a devoted lover of flowers and vegetables, and an addict of catalogs. She was also well along in years and had arrived at her opinions over a long period of time and after much gardening. In addition to surprising thousands of New Yorker readers and dozens of seedsmen, Catherine managed to startle a third party, me, her husband. I felt both surprise and apprehension at this curious and unexpected development. I had observed my wife as a gardener, but never thought of her as an authority on horticultural matters, though she clearly was a devotee. I did not regard her as a scientist, and I wondered whether she realized what she was getting into, but I did know that she need bow to no one in her love of flower and form and her devotion to the spirit and task of gardening. Writing for her was an agonizing ordeal. Writing is hard work for almost everyone. For Catherine, it was particularly hard because she was by temperament and profession an editor, not a writer. When she sat down to compose a magazine piece on gardening, faced with all the strictures and disciplines of formal composition and suffering the uneasiness that goes with critical expression in public print, this was something else again. Gone was the clear and steady stream. Catherine's act of composition often achieved the turbulence of a shootout. The editor in her fought the writer every inch of the way. The struggle was felt all through the house. She would write 8 or 10 words, then draw her gun and shoot them down. This made for slow and torturous going. It was simple warfare. The editor ready to nip the writer before she committed all the sins and errors that editors clearly foresaw. Occasionally, I ribbed her about the pain she inflicted on herself. "Just go ahead and write," I said. "Edit afterwards. There's plenty of time." My advice never had any effect on her. She fought herself with vigor and conviction from the first sentence to the last, drawing blood the whole way. I worried about her health, which was not good. Luckily, she always did her homework and never started to write anything until she knew what she was talking about. In bringing these pieces together in a book, I draw encouragement from a number of sources. First, she herself had hoped to bring out a garden book. She kept putting the matter off because she wanted to expand her existing articles and write one more piece, a reminiscence about gardens of her childhood. Second, a number of people whose judgment I had valued urged Catherine to put her material into a book. Marianne Moore was, I think, the first one to persuade her that the New Yorker pieces should be preserved between covers. Finally, when I got around to reading the articles, I discovered to my great joy that though they began 20 years ago, they still seemed fresh. There had been, of course, many changes in the cast of characters and the business firms, but there was a quality in her work that the years did not diminish. Her excitement at growing things, her belief in the worth of gardening, her fascination with the architects who were behind the catalogs, these were timeless. She held the whole world of flowers in a warm embrace. Her pieces were intensely personal and charged with emotion. To write of Catherine simply as a gardener would be like writing of Ben Franklin simply as a printer. Gardening was indeed part of her, but never her major interest, consuming all her thoughts and all her talents. She simply accepted the act of gardening as a natural thing to be occupied with in one's spare time, no matter where one was or how deeply involved in other affairs. "Although I have gardened all my life," she wrote to a reader in 1959, "I'm very much an amateur, and I'm only beginning to know a little about the many nurseries that specialize." Amateur she was, but although she lacked a special knowledge and background of science, she was bountifully endowed with strong feelings and sure taste for what was simple and good, and the excitement and the fun that came with the discovery. She had fierce loyalty to common gifts of nature, goldenrod, pussy willows, dandelions, violets, wildflowers, and she began evaluating the catalogs of the professionals. She was enchanted to find that these articulate nurserymen were not just names on a page, that they were live actors on her chosen stage. They were writers. They were opinionated and with personal bias. They fascinated her but failed to intimidate her. When Amos Pettingill, the sage of White Flower Farm, whose name sounded a bit too Dickensian for her taste, described in his catalog of French pussy willow as, quote, not the unreliable wild pussy willow. This was too much for my New England wife. What is unreliable, pray, about the native wild pussies, she retorted. I have found them trustworthy in every respect. I did not know at the time and still don't know what moved Catherine to write that first garden piece. Ever since I'd known her, she'd been surrounded by seed catalogs. In wintertime, by seedlings pushing up in flats in the spring, and she always had arranged bouquets for our house or apartment. Onward and Upward, her title, a phrase swiped from the Unitarian Creed, had often appeared in the New Yorker as a heading in other contexts. It was Catherine's invention, however, and it proved a happy choice of title for her adventure in garden writing. After 2 years of giving the catalogs an annual going over and assessing the prose style and idiosyncrasies of the writers, she set to work, Onward and Upward, exploring other aspects of the garden world, the history of gardens, the literature of gardens, the arranging of flowers, the herbalists, the trends and developments. Not only was she traditional by nature, Catherine showed a strong streak of parochialism in her approach to gardening. New England was what she knew as a child, and the roots of her ancestors were deep in the soil of Maine and Massachusetts. The things that grew in New England, therefore, were her correct. They occupied a special place in her heart, an authenticity not enjoyed by flowers that made the mistake of blooming in other sections of the country. In my bumbling way, I ran straight to the regional bias when I introduced a few camellia plants into the small greenhouse we had acquired. This was in the last years of her life when her days were becoming increasingly dreary because of invalidism, and I was casting about for ways to give her a few scattered moments of pleasure against the somber backdrop of illness. I must have seen years before that she had written about camellias. Quote, my eye admires them even while my taste rejects them. I live in an old New England farmhouse against which these lush blooms look out of period. I read it, I guess, but it must have gone out of my mind. So I sent off for several camellia plants, thinking to cheer her up. The plants arrived from the West Coast by Greyhound bus and soon came into bloom. Tiffany, Betty Sheffield, Supreme, Ville de Nance, and other handsome little things. Proud of myself, I would make a quick early trip to the greenhouse, come back with a single flower, put it in a tiny vase, and have it on the tray when I carried her breakfast up to her room. Just a small surprise, courtesy of the management. Oh, how pretty, she would exclaim, but Catherine was never any good at concealing her true feelings. She would have been the world's worst poker player. I soon detected on these early morning visits a forced note in her voice. I could almost hear her muttering under her breath, now, what is a southern flower doing in my main bedroom? Now I'll turn to Catherine's own writing after her husband's loving introduction, and you'll get a feeling for how she did indeed love visualizing the flower seeds that she would send for from the catalogs. For gardeners, this is a season of lists and callow hopefulness. Hundreds of thousands of bewitched readers are poring over their catalogs, making lists for their seed and plant orders, and dreaming their dreams. Catherine goes on to ponder the question of whether all change is good. And as you would imagine, she decides that especially in the matter of flowers, bigger is not always better. She had said at one point, now, I like chrysanthemums, but why should zinnias be made to look like chrysanthemums? And then she goes on to say, it's not only these transmogrifications of old favorites that trouble me. I'm equally bothered by the onward and upward cry of the seedsmen and plant growers. Of course, this is nothing new. The trend since almost the beginning of time has been to grow things that are bigger and better. Better, I go for. to grow things, roses that bloom all summer, daylilies that stay open longer, lettuce that doesn't bolt, corn that will not wilt, string beans without strings. The hybridizers, with an assist, perhaps from the chemist, are responsible for all these blessings. But as for flowers, I've never been able to persuade myself that the biggest blooms are necessarily the most beautiful. The peace, the rose called peace, the rose of the century, one cataloger terms it. Everybody knows this huge rosy yellow rose, and nearly everybody admires it and tries to grow it, in spite of its lovely colors. Well, I don't like peace. Even a small vase full of peace roses is grotesque to me. And on the bush, the blossoms look to me like the cabbagey tenille roses of the Queen's croquet garden. The white ones Alice found the card gardeners hurriedly painting red against the arrival of the Queen. Lewis Carroll was prophetic. Today, the garden men are quite as busy changing the color of flowers as they are changing their size and shape. This is an indication of Catherine's spirit and her strong opinions, and I look forward to reading from Onward and Upward in the Garden again. This is Helen Cannon. Thank you.
Helen is a former instructor of English at USU and a lover of literature and gardening. Thanks for joining us again, Helen. In our gardening calendar, this Saturday, we have a couple of different items. First, jumpstart your landscape with some homemade compost. Aside from giving veggies and flowers a healthy start, composting encourages beneficial organisms in the soil. There's a hands-on class about composting. Dress for the outdoors. This is in Iron County, and you call 435-586-8132 for more information. And then that's from 10 to 12. From 10 to 11 Saturday morning, the Tahnequint Nature Center in St. George is holding a cactus and succulents workshop from 10 to 11. You'll learn about plant selections and the general scope of cactus and succulent rearing. And a complete list of their free workshops is at the center is available at dixiegardener.org. And then Thursday, June 13th, 6 to 8 p.m., learn how to select and properly plant the right plants for your landscape. You'll be shown plants that will perform well in the landscape and save water. It is free, but all participants must register. Again, this is at the Iron County USU Extension Office, 435-586-8132. And now in the last couple of minutes of the program, I wanted to take just a few minutes to talk about iris. Now, with full disclosure here, I am president of the Logan Iris Society, but I figured it was my prerogative to be able to talk about iris since I love them so much. That's not to say that I know a lot about them. You show up at a meeting and you can get shanghaied onto the board pretty easily, but we'd love to have you come out. And one of the people that has helped educate me about iris is Brad Kasparek. Brad is a hybridizer of iris, and he is a co-owner of Zebra Gardens just south of Tremonton in Elwood. Brad, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Brian.
This is a busy time of the year for you, so we'll just take a couple of minutes of your time. And what I wanted to talk about today are spurria iris. Now, you've hybridized a lot of different tall bearded iris, but you've lately been moving into spurria iris. Why don't you explain what spurria iris are and where people might want to put them into their garden? They're nice because they come on 2 to 3 weeks after tall bearded iris and kind of help extend the iris season.
Spurria iris, I can't really explain what they are, but generally they grow in clumps, the foliage about at 3 feet, possibly 3.5 feet, and they bloom with stalks that usually come up another foot above the foliage. Now, they make good background plants because in a garden or a landscape, because they can be planted, they're tall when they bloom, and they can be left in place for a long time. They enlarge, they're happy, they'll enlarge steadily in a circular fashion. And I have clumps here that I have grown for 15 years in the same spot. I would say you probably should transplant maybe around every 10 years, but they will keep growing.
So unlike the tall bearded that should be divided about every 4 years or so, you can keep the spurrea in the same place.
Yes, they can stay in the same place for quite a long time.
Do they keep blossoming in the middle of the clump, unlike the tall bearded?
It all depends on the variety and whether or not you water and continue to water and fertilize the inner portion of the clump. They can grow with a hollow center, unfortunately, unless you make sure that the center receives as much water and fertilizer as the outer ring of foliage does, so the new shoots can grow back towards the center. There still are a lot of varieties of Iris spurrea that will grow hollow no matter what you try to do.
Now, the spurreas tend to grow, how tall would you say they are? About 4 feet? But at the top of the leaves?
Yes, I would say they're about 3 to 3.5 feet tall. There are many that grow shorter than that. They will grow foliage that's only more like 30 inches or so, and you want them to put up a bloom stalk that will probably extend a foot higher than the tips of the foliage.
So these are taller than most of the tall bearded, generally.
Oh, yeah, these are taller than the, yes, they're generally much taller than tall bearded.
And as far as their care, do they tend to do better with a little bit more watering than the tall bearded? I know tall bearded, you could leave them alone if you wanted to, and they'd be okay. Can you do that with the spurrea?
Spurreas are just about, well, are really just as drought tolerant as tall bearded iris are. It's just a little bit different on your timing, because when you start to cut, you need to water until your bloom season ends. And the same thing with bearded iris. And then you can let them more or less go dormant. I still tend to give them a shot of water every 7 to 10 days, even during the summertime. But once they sense dormancy, they stop growing anyway. And they will stay dormant pretty much well into the middle or end of August.
But they'll they'll stay green, though?
Okay, now you got a trick question. A lot of the spurreas, I'm afraid, the foliage starts to fade on you in the sense that it can start to turn brown and may bend over, may bend kink, literally. During the long summer, you can minimize that by doing what I suggested, giving them a good watering maybe every 10 days during the dormant period. But some of them will still do it.
Well, and where can you find spurrea iris? Now, I know you've got quite a few of them over at your place, but can people come over there if they arrange a time to come and take a look at them?
Well, yes, here at Zebra Gardens, visitors and purchasers are welcome to come and look at the bloom when it's ongoing. Right at the moment, I think the peak bloom is going to be somewhere between maybe the 16th of June and maybe a week and a half after that. It all depends on this heat, and I don't like the forecast, to tell you the truth.
Because it gets a little too hot, and those flowers just don't last very long.
Yes, that's the problem.
Well, Brad, I appreciate you taking the time out of your... This is really the busy time of the year for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Brian.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and my guest was Brad Kasparek, owner of Zebra Gardens in Elwood, just south of Tremont, and he does have an online website with Zebra Gardens. And related to iris, with last community calendar, the peak of the tall bearded iris season is this weekend, and the Logan Iris Society invites you on a tour to see locally grown iris. Members of the society are opening their gardens for you to see some of the best iris varieties introduced in the last 20 years. The tour is this Saturday from 4 until 7 p.m. Five different gardens are included. To begin the tour, go to my house in Hyde Park at 171 West 300 North, and a listing of all the gardens on the tour will be handed out at the location. Additional information can be obtained at our website at upr.org. Thank you for joining us on The Zesty Garden.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1, 91.5 Logan.